It's Friday. It's 4:05. And you know what happens here? We go beyond borders. Yet today we're really, 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 really going beyond borders. Okay, like really pushing the boundaries. Yes, you know, you all want to go and move to Canada. Well, I'll be speaking to a Canadian. But he's not in Canada today, I don't think. He'll tell us where he is. Welcome to Borderlines. My guest, it's actually a very, very special show. And I'm going to tell you why. And I want you all to sit back, relax, grab water, be very ready. Because there's going to be some healing being done today. Yes, I know we don't do that on Borderlines all the time, but, you know, today we'll probably be doing some healing. When you know who my guest is, you'll understand why. But he's also actually very blunt. So I don't know, you might need to balance yourself a little bit, you know. So the studio line is 0700-993-993-993. The female-only line is 0201-465-7190. But as you know, on Borderlines, you send WhatsApp messages. We will try and put, you know, give some time for questions, but it's always best to send your WhatsApp, your questions by WhatsApp, your messages or whatever at 0809-597-5805. We are live on our website, NigeriaInfo.fm. We are also live on Facebook and YouTube, NigeriaInfo99.3. We are on Twitter. I still call it Twitter. I don't know about all that X business. NigeriaInfo.fm, Instagram and Threads, NigeriaInfo.fm Lagos. So let me tell you about my guest. His name is Daniel Mate. You're thinking, who is Daniel Mate? Keep telling all of you people, you must do the research. Daniel Mate is a composer. We call him a trauma expert, but he'll probably correct me and say, no, I don't know if I'm a trauma expert, but let's stick with that for now. But he's also an activist. He's an award-winning musical theatre composer, lyricist, playwright, and co-author of national and number one New York Times bestseller, The Myth of Normal: Trauma, Illness, and Healing in a Toxic Culture. That's part of what I'm going to be talking to Daniel today. But even more so, Daniel is also, I think I'm right to say, what is he? Second generation Holocaust survivor. So his dad is probably the first generation and he would be the second. So yes, we've got a lot. Daniel, I've talked too much. Welcome.
Hello, hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. I'm Ireti. I am your host, pronounced with an E, spelt with an I. Because people are, you know, when I interview the Amaz guy, he still calls me RT. I don't know whether that's Russian television or what.
Ireti. You know,
yes, right? Ireti. Yes, you got it completely. Yeah. How are you doing?
Well, I'm a little jet lagged and a little bit throat compromised, but I'm here. I'm physically all here, and I expect that as this conversation goes on, other parts of me will arrive too.
Okay, great.
I got in from Paris late last night.
So you're back in Canada, are you?
No, I'm back in Brooklyn, New York.
In Brooklyn. So are you based in Brooklyn?
Yes.
Okay, great. So I was wrong to call you Canadian then. Why did
I am from Canada.
Right. Okay.
Brilliant. I was born in Vancouver, raised there, but I've lived a good part of my adult life in the States.
Okay, great. In this day and time, we must ask everybody how they are. That question, how are you, can no longer be taken for granted, and it can no longer be answered with, I'm fine. You know, so when I ask, I literally mean, how are you? Because especially somebody like you, like I said earlier, you are, you know, arguably second generation Holocaust survivor. You are the son of Gabon Mate, who is first generation survivor, I think I would say. I mean, that is your dad, but you can correct me on that. So talk to me about that heritage of yours.
Well, how I am is that, you know, I'm struggling through this moment as so many of us are, or I guess as everyone is, whether they know it or not, we're all struggling in the same waters, although we don't all experience them the same way. You know, you mentioned my activism, and my mind has been very much on what's been going on in Gaza and the rest of Palestine and Israel for the past several months. And I've been very active. Most of my time on social media is spent trying to raise awareness and to spread information that needs to be spread, amplifying voices that need to be amplified, satirizing whatever needs to be.
I enjoy your satire. Yes.
Yeah. Thank you. So, you know, all of that, you know, it gives me something to do every day. And I can use my mind to do it. And then sometimes I wake up out of my busyness and I realize the occasion for it all. Like it can become a little abstract, like, oh, another day at the mill, you know, or in the content mines. And you don't realize sometimes you can get, I can get numb actually to the reality of what's going on. And you see pictures and it's so crazy because you'd think that how can we ignore it if we're looking right at it, but looking at it and being present to the calamity and horror of it is another thing. And I think it's just bigger than any of us can handle.
Indeed.
So, you know, this is a morning where I'm feeling a bit depleted. You can hear it in my voice. I'm not maybe as quick. I can't do my usual tap dance on the thin ice that my mind lets me do every day, which in a way is a superpower because it allows me to comment on what's going on in a way that gives people some, I don't know, some lightness, some nimbleness, maybe some levity at moments, but some quickness of thought. But on a day like today, I don't have that in me. I just don't have, my superpowers sometimes need to recharge. So it's one of these days where I just need to take it very slow. And when I take it slow, I can feel just the heaviness and the sadness and the horror and the almost crushing enormity of the thing. And of course, look, every moment I've been alive in my 48 years on Earth, there were calamitous things happening somewhere. I just didn't know about them. But this is one of these cases where, you know, life and the world have conspired to make us know what's going on here. And it's an issue that rivets me in a way that none other does because I'm Jewish. And because, as you said, I'm the son of someone who barely survived the Holocaust. He nor my grandparents were never in any of the concentration camps, but his aunt was, his grandparents died there. And they barely made it out of the Budapest ghetto alive. And then they fled Hungary to Canada in 1956, escaped the Hungarian Revolution. So twice in my dad's, you know, early life, he was dealing with bombardment, deprivation, war, circumstances way beyond his control. So that stuff's just in me. It's just in my family lore. It's probably in my DNA if epigenetics are all they're cracked up to be. And then more personally for me, or at least in my own, biographical timeline, I grew up going to a summer camp that was very Israel focused. I lived for 10 months on a kibbutz in Israel. I grew up learning some Hebrew and being educated in a kind of liberal, pro-Israel environment, not at home so much, but at summer camp. And those were some of my favorite days. That was like my favorite place on earth. It was kind of a utopia. And so there was a lot of identification with that country and with that aspect of being Jewish, the national modern side of things, and to watch it just unraveling the way it is, and we can get into it more. Just answering your opening question in a general way, but just to watch the trajectory of what's happening to that country is pick your D word: depressing, disturbing, dismaying, discombobulating, disorienting. And then, of course, there's the Palestinians and what they're going through, and I mean, they're not an afterthought. They are first and foremost. What they're going through right now and what their people all over the world must be going through is, it's beyond my own imagining. So just the horror of it, the twisted psychology of it all, the propagandistic contortions that people who are trying to prop it up or justify it or deny it or push it away are currently going through. It's just it's grotesque and gutting on a level that I don't think I've ever seen.
And this is the thing. As you've spoken about how you're proudly Jewish, you've spoken about your dad, and you've talked about going to summer school, Zionist summer school. But you've also said, since this genocide, now we can officially call it a genocide, since this genocide began, you said you found your heart hardening towards Israeli suffering. That's kind of quotes from me. Of yours, rather. Talk to me about that. You know, how do you... There's a conflict that we all deal with, of course, with this, with this whole genocide, but even more so for you and for your dad. How do you balance that?
That's a great question. I think you're quoting me from an event that my father and I did online.
A couple of days ago. Week. Yeah.
A week ago today, actually.
Yes.
And we did a Q&A session for, you know, listeners all over the world. And we were actually, there was an Israeli woman, or an Israeli-American woman, I should say, American-born Israeli citizen living in Jerusalem, who called in and was very distressed by our positions on this stuff, felt that we were overlooking Israeli suffering, and of course had a whole bunch of other complaints about the way we were minimizing Islamic fundamentalism and all that other stuff. But the part of her question that I took the most seriously, or you know, in the best faith, was her sense of somehow not feeling the empathy from us, not feeling it. You know, we could say that we care about all people, but she just didn't feel that our way of being was conveying a real sense of compassion for what Israelis went through on October 7th and have been going through since. And that's when I actually had to stop and pause, because I could have just argued with her. I could have been right about it. And I think that ultimately justice and history and facts are on the side that I'm on. And I think I could easily justify devoting the largest percentage of my time to highlighting Palestinian suffering, given the preponderance of power, given the fact that I'm living in the country that is making Israel's genocide possible, given the fact that, as Noam Chomsky said, for citizens in a free society, it's your primary responsibility to call out your own side, not to, you know, be pointing the finger at what the other guy's doing. So I had all of that in my arsenal, and I was tempted to do it, but I felt a kind of constriction in me. And this is the thing, you know, my dad and I had advertised this event, or the organization we were doing it with had advertised the event as navigating difficult conversations. You know, in our guise as co-authors of a book about trauma, illness, and healing, here we were talking to people in a moment where everybody is distressed, no matter where they're coming from. So for me to just double down on being right in the face of this woman's anguish, I could just feel a kind of hardening. Like, I hated what she was saying. I could feel in myself an impatience, a kind of, you know, nothing she was saying was going to get through the gates of my occupation wall. I've been using a lot of highly inappropriate political metaphors to describe the inner emotional landscape lately, and I like it, because it's, you know, the fact is everything that's happening on the outer level is happening on the inner level too. And I just chose, you know what, let me have some integrity here, because we say this is about compassion and healing. Well, so where's the compassionate thing? Well, first of all, would be to have enough compassion for myself and enough respect for myself and for her to just to tell the truth. And I said, you know what? The truth is, when I hear you talk, I realize there's a part of me that has been very hardened to Israeli suffering. And I don't want to hear about Jewish suffering right now. I don't want to hear about it.
Why?
And I get, well, so here's the thing. I think there are valid reasons that I don't want to hear about it, but there being valid reasons and me using those reasons as a pretext to shut off my heart are two different things.
Right.
I often say in my mental chiropractic work, that's my modality where I work with people, you know, it's there's a difference between being accurate and being right. So here's what I think is accurate. in this moment, there is an active genocide going on of a captive civilian population. Every single day, hundreds of children are dying. People are now starving. People are being brutalized in every way imaginable. It has been going on for 4 months, almost 5 months now. The world is standing by and watching, with the noble exception of places like South Africa and other countries that are trying to get some leverage to stop this nightmare. But the real power centers in the world are fully on side with it and are hypocritically claiming to care about Palestinian life and pretending that they want Israel to slow things down while providing, and I'm speaking now about the country where I live, while providing the bombs, weapons, and diplomatic immunity in the form of vetoes that allows it to continue. So that's the situation. Plus, you have a corporate media that's completely beholden to whatever the U.S. security state wants. And currently, what the U.S. security state wants is for Israel to be allowed to continue pretty much unimpeded. So in that situation, I consider it, the most neutral way to put it is inappropriate.
Mm-hmm.
To focus on much else.
Right.
Now, yes, Israelis suffered on October 7th terribly, and it was a national trauma for the country. It was a direct material trauma to those communities and to those people who lost their lives and all of their families. And it was an emotional and psychological trauma to that country, and by extension to Jews around the world who identify with that country. I do not identify with that country. It calls itself the Jewish state. It does so without my consent.
I actually would like to you to talk about that as well.
Yeah, yeah. Let me just unpack this this thorny question first. I'd be happy to talk about it. So there's different, concentric circles of trauma. There's the direct attacks that happen. People lost their lives. People were murdered. People were, it seems, brutalized. Their families have suffered terribly, because that's what happens when your loved ones are murdered. Some people were taken hostage. Those people have suffered. Their families have suffered. And then it's ripples in a pond outward to the whole society. So it's a shock to the to a country's national self-image, and it's shocking.
Mm-hmm.
That was one day. That was one day, almost 5 months ago now. Okay. Now, so even just on the surface of the proportions and the percentages of who has suffered and when they have suffered and how many days in a row they have suffered. You know, who's being murdered every day? Who's being bombed every day? Who's being starved? How many children and how many civilians and how many journalists and how many medical personnel and how many universities? And, you know, just on every single metric, there is no comparison, which doesn't change the fact that October 7th was horrible. But if we're going to be proportional about it, it's actually not at all inappropriate to be spending 99% of our time focusing on Palestinian suffering, because it's also ongoing. And then you fold into the mix a couple of other factors. Number one, October 7th didn't happen out of the blue. The reason October 7th happened, and this is, of course, not what Israeli propagandists and their apologists all over the world want you to hear. But why did October 7th happen? Well, their explanation is it's because Muslims hate Jews or something. Palestinian babies wake up in the middle of the night crying and they don't want milk. They want Jewish blood or something like that. You know, this is the narrative. I mean, it's literally what was said about us when we were the unwanted subhumans of a country or a region.
Europe and Germany.
Yeah, Europe, exactly, yes. Right? It's classic. No, in fact, the people who broke out of that ghetto or that concentration camp or that internment camp or open-air prison or whatever you want to call Gaza was not a you know, it's not an open border. Israel has controlled that place from the outside since it, quote unquote, withdrew in 2005. The lives of the people in there are very, very, very constrained and often put in great danger because Israel bombs regularly every few years, calls it mowing the lawn. Anyway, I could go off in a million different directions to get into the details, but the fact is the focus on Jewish pain and suffering always, in the way that Israel tends to use it, is always used as a justification and a pretext for more of the same. And what is the same? It's the same conditions that create October 7th, which is you're occupying a people, you're oppressing a people. Which people? The people that you tried to ethnically cleanse out of their homeland in 1948. So this goes back 100 years with a deliberate colonial project aimed at taking a land that one people lived on, and of course Jews lived there too, but not European Jews, Arab Jews, and making essentially a supremacist state for a people largely imported. And, you know, of course your continent knows a little something about this. And the implications of that, and what kind of a deadlock that creates until freedom and justice are won. So October 7th happened in the context of that. And you don't have to like October 7th. You don't have to feel any sympathy for the people who did it. But you do have to, if you don't want it to happen again, you have to understand who these people were and where they came from. And so all the usual excuses that, oh, well, it's just Jew hatred. It's not Jew hatred at all. Those people had no problem with me. They had problems with the people with their boots on their necks and the necks of their families, and we've been massacring their people for a long time. So in that context, when I hear Jews talking about how traumatized they are, and many Jews talking about how traumatized they are just kind of traumatized ambiently, like October 7th scared them, right? It made us uncomfortable. It's upsetting. And we got afraid and we got triggered. Now, it's totally understandable that you would. It was a brutal attack. It was shocking. And also in the general power scheme of the status quo, it wasn't supposed to happen. That doesn't happen to Israelis. Israel's the strong one, and Israel got humiliated. So there's a lot of reasons why Jews would feel upset. But Jewish leaders all over the world, taking orders essentially from, you know, the self-appointed leaders of the Jewish people at the head of the Israeli government, have been exploiting that trauma and exacerbating it and making sure that every day since October 7th is still October 7th for Jewish people, which means we're in a kind of trauma vortex. That's what I see. Where, not we, but many Jews are in a trauma vortex where every day is October 7th, and October 7th is Kristallnacht, and it's history happening to us all over again, which makes us completely unable to discern what might be different about this situation. You know, on Passover, the four questions we ask are all geared around, why is this night different than all other nights? You know, and I might encourage Jews, if we could take just a step back and say, why is this attack on Jews different than all other attack on Jews?
Yeah.
Well, one difference might be that we might have done something to actually provoke it, because we might have an occupying army that's immiserating another people who just want their freedom the way we've always wanted ours. So this is why I have a hard time taking seriously
Jewish suffering.
Emotional, you know, Jewish fragility, I could even say.
Yes.
I wanted to use sort of more woke social justice language. And at the same time, if I'm going to be effective in talking to someone one-on-one, like with this woman on that call, I had to say, you know what? Slow down. I have my opinions, but let me just breathe for a second and remember that you are in a state of panic right now. I may not agree with your assessment of why that is. I may be angry at different people than you are. I'm angry at the people who are exploiting your pain and trauma to keep you there so they can keep you cheering for or denying the genocide they're committing. But I don't need to take that out on you. And I don't need to harden my heart so much that I stop seeing Israelis as people. Because if I really soften all the way, I don't get to a place where, like, oh, it's all neutral. Everyone's the same. No, there's a huge power difference. But one thing everyone has in common here in that land is that everyone is being held hostage by Zionism. Everyone is being held hostage by the Israeli government, including the entire Jewish population of Israel.
Brilliant. Thank you. That was so rich. And there's so much to unpack and of. Oh, damn. We only have 25 minutes left. Right. So you mentioned, and I said I did want to talk about this, and I think this is really important because I'm having to actually prioritize, because talking to you, I could talk to you for 4 or 5 hours.
You ask me one question, you get 8 answers. So.
But that's great. That's what we need, because you are talking to a Nigerian audience, and, you know, not just in Nigeria, in the diaspora, many of whom, you know, there are those who are conflicted about what's going on between Israel and Palestine. There are those who are curious, who are still not convinced of who the real victims are. There are those who are questioning their religion and religiosity with regard, because they're Christians and, you know, they feel they should be siding Israel and all of that stuff.
Do they know that many of the Palestinians being killed are Christians? Do they know that Israeli bombs can't discriminate between a Palestinian Muslim and a Palestinian Christian? Have they listened to the sermon of the pastor of the Bethlehem Church on Christmas, who gave one of the most rousing religious political sermons I've ever heard? I mean, this is the thing. If you make this about religion, which it's not, you have to deal with the fact that this is not a war between Jews and Muslims. This is a war between a supremacist state and anyone who gets in its way, whether they're Muslim, Christian, or actually even Jewish.
Indeed. Thank you. We have tried to educate, but, you know, glad you, but so let me come back to my question. There are chapters in your book, you wrote a book with your dad, like I said earlier, The Myth of Normal.
Yeah.
You said there's a chapter, and it's not like I've read it, but, you know, I have skimmed through parts. And there's a chapter that says stress wreaks havoc on the body, setting the stage for disease. Yeah. And then you then go on to, there's also a third chapter that says our culture generates chronic stress and the conditions for illness. I'd like you to talk about that in the context of what's going on now. Think about that woman, and I did see her, and it was clear that she really was, I could see you getting irritated the more she spoke, but I could see her nervousness and her, why can't you understand what I'm talking about, that we are the victims and they hate us and hate us and hate us.
Yeah.
You hear that a lot from Israeli Jews, right? You're saying you're not an Israeli Jew, you are Jewish, who is Canadian, who happens to live in America, right? I think that's a good description. So talk to us about that, those two chapters, and you and that woman, in the context of what we're seeing now with Palestine on one side and the bombs coming from Israel, deleting, and I use the word deleting all the time because it's just deleterious in my opinion, deleting Palestinian generations and generations. Mm. I'm going to give you 10 minutes, Daniel, on that.
Let's see how I do.
Feel free to jump in.
Please jump in at any point. Well, what can I say? That's a lot to tie together. Well, so first of all, yeah, The Myth of Normal is the book I wrote with my dad. Primarily, it's his book with a big assist from me. You know, it's his work. He's the doctor. He's the trauma expert. He's the therapist. I'm his son who helped it read better and helped it get written and helped it feel, you know, tighter, lighter, and brighter. That was my assignment, you know. And I contributed some ideas to it, but I have to say that when discussing these topics, and this is why on Instagram I sort of said, well, I don't know if I call myself a trauma expert, because I'm not. I co-wrote a book with a trauma expert, which makes me trauma expert adjacent, I guess. Plus, I grew up
assistant
with
trauma expert. That's what we'll call
you. Assistant trauma expert, exactly. Plus, son of trauma expert.
Yeah.
That'll teach me some things about trauma, too. Look, the entire book is premised on the observation that our world stresses people out almost by design. If you wanted to design a society, and of course, when we say society, we are writing mainly about the one here on this continent that we live in, but in the globalized economy, you know, American stress manufacturing is being, globalized. So you could tell me how well this fits the Nigerian case. If you wanted to design a society that stresses people out and predisposes them to being ill in all kinds of ways, whether physically, emotionally, mentally, spiritually, you couldn't do much better than the one we're living in.
Mm.
Because health, it turns out, is not a function of having good genes or, the right kind of nutrition. Of course, that nutrition is very, very important, and genes may play a role. But in the bigger picture, health is a function of relationships. Health is a function of culture. Health is a function of the environment in which we live. And this is just the way the human body and brain are wired. We are interdependent beings. We are biologically interconnected beings. Now, this goes against the grain of what Western medicine very superstitiously teaches, or rather doesn't teach its practitioners, but any shaman or traditional healer from any country, anywhere in the world, if you could you go back 1,000 years, 2,000 years, any length of time, they'd look me in the face after I just said that and said, yeah, tell me something I don't know already. That's the fundamentals of health, right? What are the conditions needed to create a human being? Well, to understand that, you have to understand how human beings evolved. If you want to understand what sort of soil is required to grow a healthy oak tree, you have to understand what are the evolutionary needs of oak trees. What is an oak tree fundamentally? Human beings, we evolved mostly in small band hunter-gatherer groups, which is to say tight-knit community, interdependent, needing to be attuned to our own nature, to the nature of the seasons, the nature of animals, the rhythms of the world, and in a sense being obliged to those, not being able to just be all you can be and overcome any circumstance, but rather be beholden to the circumstances and find freedom inside the constraints that we're given, and live together and depend on each other and raise each other's children and have community rituals and myth making and a community based understanding of what health is. In fact, the entire idea of a completely individual autonomous self is an entirely modern distortion of how human beings always understood themselves, which is to say, we're like anything else in nature, we're connected to each other. We're not entirely autonomous. Human autonomy isn't a bad thing if we keep it in proportion. If we don't keep it in proportion, we end up with the world we have now, which is completely insane and on the verge of snuffing itself out, deleting itself, to use your word.
Let me, in fact, it's funny you say that, because so that reminds me, when you talk about this community and how we grew up, very close and everything, and that's just how humans are. Growing up in the UK, I grew up, my family house was in Northwest London, right? Northwest London is Jewish central, like literally Golders Green, Finchley, yada, you name it. I don't know what the equivalent is in America, but yeah, that's where I learned about challah bread and all of that stuff, right? So, and in what you got there was, they lived very close together, right? Very, very close together. Even you see them on Shabbat, they walk together. You don't even know who's mom, who's dad, who's this, who's that. Everybody's together. Yep. And then now, when you look at, because Palestine is in the forefront, and in fact, the Palestinian culture and family structure is very much at risk at the moment, you learn that Palestinians are pretty much the same way. Mom and dad live on one floor, and then another son will live on one floor, and then another one. And it's just amazing the parallel of our humanity and how, when all is said and done, we're just so much of the same, really.
Well, any culture that hasn't completely lost itself is going to be tied to these more ancient understandings of what it takes to be a human being and what it takes to be a people that can survive. And of course, togetherness is a key part of that, So absolutely, in the assimilated West, there's less and less of that. But that is what we evolved to be. So if you set up a society that's then predicated on some other notion, like the power of the individual or the pursuit of happiness, which is to say, chasing an illusory future where you'll one day have enough stuff, and in the meantime, you got to get as much stuff as you can. Or a society that's predicated on extracting from the land every single thing we can without any connection to past or future generations. These are the imperatives of a capitalist, imperialist world, and they will create a different sort of living environment in which we grow up deracinated, uprooted, cut off from ourselves, not knowing who we are. And that's on the existential level, but it's also on the level of mental health. And there are physical substrates to that too, which I won't get into. That's my dad's work, but we talk about it in the book. You know, our immune systems, our emotional systems, these are all connected. So I'm not sure how that connects to the woman we were speaking about, but...
Well, your rejection of Israel as a Jewish person...
Well, but that's a slightly separate question. I mean, I have sort of certain... I do, you know... I just don't think... to me, my Judaism is not a nationality, and it's not a flag, and it's not an army. It's just not what it is. I think Zionism, which is the political movement that came along to purportedly save the Jews from the cruelties of exile and wandering and homelessness, has... made things worse. And I think this was predictable. There were Jews before the State of Israel was created, including Albert Einstein, who warned, if you try to take the Jewish people and turn us into some kind of modern nation, which has to rule by force over another people, especially if we have to kind of invade or settle or colonize their land and expect them to just go away. And since they're not going to go away, then we're just going to have to kill them or push them out. We do that, we're going to lose what makes Judaism so valuable, which is that outsider perspective, a sense of moral principles, a kind of a deep connection to justice, a universalism, and a trust that there is something bigger than us going on, so that we don't get to call the shots. You know, the Orthodox Jews who oppose Israel on religious grounds say that it's sacrilege, that Jews decided, okay, now we get to decide when we go back to the Holy Land. It's our time now. They say, no, God will decide that.
Mm.
That's the Messiah, that we wait for the Messiah. We don't try to force the issue. So I just can't identify with a country that does what Israel does and calls itself Jewish. Now, I guess in the abstract, the idea of a Jewish country, sure, it's a nice idea. But we don't live in an ideal world, we live in a real world. And from the very start, when Jews in Europe started imagining a Jewish state in Palestine, they quickly recognized that there was a problem. There was another people there, which is why they made up this canard of a land without people for a people without a land. That's exactly what it wasn't. It was a land with people. It was a people that belonged to a land there. And we were a people that didn't belong to any land, and we wanted to come and take theirs. Well, whatever the result of that's going to be, I don't want any part of it. That's not my Judaism. Now, I understand, again, I can switch to my more compassionate side, having family who barely survived the Holocaust. Is it understandable that a people who's been, you know, whose existence has been at best tenuous for a long time, for thousands of years, would eventually, and then something like the Holocaust happens, they say, enough of this, I want in on the this is our land kind of game, you know? I don't want to be at the butt end of the power dynamic anymore. Is that understandable? Yes, it's understandable. But just because it's understandable doesn't mean it's advisable. And there are consequences. And this has been understood since way before the Holocaust. So it's not even about the Holocaust. You know, there were already designs on an ethnic cleansing project in Palestine. And then the Holocaust just accelerated things. So, yeah, I reject, I don't reject Israelis. Israelis are human beings like me, and they're people of Jewish descent like me.
Mm.
What I reject is the country that purports to speak for me, and to bomb for me and kill for me and maim for me and torture for me. Because the fact is, when you start out that way, when your origin story is, we had to kick them off their land to create land for ourselves, and now we just want them to go away, it's only going to end in genocide or something like it. And that's what we see now. And it's an ugly, ugly society that still has some very good people in it.
Indeed.
But any thread of kind of progressive, peace-loving, liberal-minded values that used to exist alongside the hardline right wing in Israel has almost entirely been eradicated. It's a very scary situation.
Talk to me about what... So in America, the majority that I see online anyway, and especially...
Sorry, I'm just going to put myself on mute to listen to your question. I just need to step away for a second.
Okay.
Just keep going until I get back.
Yes, sure. So... When you look on social media, and it's certainly when you listen to, you know, if you like liberal American news, I'm not sure if CNN still falls into that space, but the majority of ordinary quote unquote Americans are pro-Israel, I mean pro-Palestine, and anti the current genocide, or as Israel would like to call it, war, whatever it is you like to call it. And many of them, there's an overriding, or there's a thread that shows over and over again, a recurring trend is, I resent my taxes being used to kill, you know, innocent children, women, even men. I resent my taxes being used for this genocidal purpose. Is America going through a sort of, how'd you say, guilt, taxpayers' guilt, or conflict, or even if you like, some sort of proxy responsibility, you know, to this deletion that we're watching, deletion of the Palestinians?
I wish. Look, the thing is, you could pick any year in the past 50 or 60 years, and Americans would have great, you know, very strong cause to say, I don't want my tax dollars going to fund this foreign policy agenda, whether it's Korea or Vietnam or Cambodia or Central America or wherever else the United States decides it wants to put its imprint and causes huge disaster all over the world. And in the process, deprioritizes ending homelessness here, which it could with the amount of money the U.S. sends to Ukraine in a single aid package could take a huge bite out of American homelessness. I mean, it's not just Gaza and Israel. I mean, the Gaza situation is so glaring and so galling, and we have social media now, so we have basically genocide in our pockets, you know, in our phones, you know, we can pull it out and see another image. And so that might potentiate a kind of accelerated sense of, hell no, I don't want my tax dollars going there. But I don't see any real organized tax revolt happening. And it's nothing new. The American centers of power have never cared what their citizens think. It's not really a democratic society. It's an oligarchy that, you know, where the governing, you know, the executive board gets ratified every couple of years by kind of perfunctory exercise and electoral shoulder shrugging. But no, I don't sense that we're, I mean, I really wish it was true. But if that was true, then it would have to be true about a lot of things, because the entirety of U.S. foreign policy spending has nothing to do with true American interests or even American values, whatever that means. It has to do with preserving the power and privilege of a very few, including the military-industrial complex, who, make no mistake, have no interest in seeing the genocide in Gaza end, or the war in Ukraine end, or any of these other conflicts, because that's their business. You know, as the title of the Megadeth album, "Killing is my business, and business is good."
There's a, so, you know, the UK, you've got, well, feel like two party, even though, you know, there's the SNP, etc., right? In America, though, there's this contraption of a two-party system. You're either a Dem or you're a Republican. But now, that used to be okay until now, because Democrats are in power, Biden is in power, and Biden is supporting this genocide, right? And then you've got Trump, who is the Republican, who naturally Democrats would never want anything to do with, especially liberal Democrats, right? But now the same Democrats are angry with Biden. But Trump is not a choice. What to do? I mean, I actually do feel sorry for you Americans right now, because it's like, what choice do you have?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess if you say that it's been okay up until now, I'd say okay for who?
Okay.
I don't think it's been okay. I think we're seeing just like October 7th was the explosion of an existing powder keg that couldn't, it was not sustainable.
Mm.
This breakdown of along partisan lines, it's just a complete unification of the uniparty. You know, essentially the Democrats and the Republicans are the same party. The Republicans have a populist wing and Trump is the wild card. I'll tell you something. I'd rather Trump was in power right now. And I'm not a Trump fan.
Do you think, many have said you wouldn't have gone, it wouldn't have supported the war. Is that correct?
I'm not saying that. I think he's very unpredictable. I think he wakes up in the morning and decides based on whether his breakfast flakes float or sink, I don't think he has much substance to him whatsoever. He sometimes is observant about the way power politics work.
Mm.
But what I'm saying is, and certainly his rhetoric has been genocidally Zionist as much as Biden's has been, sometimes, especially when he's the opposing candidate, he tries to, up the ante. But you know who would have a harder time supporting it if Trump was in power? All these liberal, democratic, Hollywood types, Hillary Clinton, all the people who have called Trump the bad satanic orange man.
Right.
Well, they'd find themselves uncomfortably close to him.
Yes.
On an issue of mass death across the world, where women and children and babies are being starved and an entire civilization is being reduced to rubble. You want to be on Trump's side? So I prefer the Democrats as an opposition party, because at least then they have to pretend that they oppose it. Right now, I mean, but you couldn't do worse than what Biden's doing. And with Biden in power, you get this sort of mealy mouth. We really care about Palestinian life. And we've had hard talks with our good friend Israel. No, you haven't. He could end it tomorrow if he actually wanted to. What I prefer about Trump is he's a liar, but he's an honest liar. He's not a hypocrite. He doesn't have the sanctimony. He's not trying to sell you on his virtue. He's a blunt power monster, unapologetically so. And I'd rather, it's like what Malcolm X said about the wolf and the fox. I'd rather see the wolf, who I can see coming, than the fox, who tries to put on a nice liberal smile and convince me that he's my friend.
Indeed. We've got, how long have I got left? Four minutes or so. Right, I want to talk to you about music and healing, because that is your thing. So if you could talk about that, and then I'm just going to give you the two questions. And finally, you said on that same program, you said the word you heard most in Israel was sheket, which is quiet. And then you went on to say peace and quiet is not peace. Peace and justice is peace. Daniel, I'm going to give him, 3 minutes? Over to you. For both. But talk to us about music and healing first, because that's thing.
No.
Really?
That's a whole other conversation.
Going to have to come back. Do you promise to come back?
Music and healing. Music is good. Healing is good. Let's do more of both. That's my platform.
Okay.
look, healing is about, healing is, the definition of healing is not getting better. It's not cure. It's wholeness. It's moving towards wholeness. And music is one of those incredible things that human beings have tapped into or invented or channeled that helps bring more wholeness into our experience of the world. So it's no wonder that music is such a powerful healing tool. As far as peace and justice being the only peace worth the name, I mean, I'm not being moralistic here. I'm just being pragmatic. if peace and quiet is predicated on another people being subjected or subjugated and their rights suppressed or being expelled or pushed away, what do you think is going to happen to those people? Unless you exterminate them all. This is the thing. If Zionism was really serious about what it wanted to do, it would just finish the job it started in 1948. I'm certainly not praying or advocating for this. But, you know, at least the Nazis were like, let's just get it done already. Let's just get rid of these Jews. You know, they meant business. They had a final solution. Israel wants a kind of protracted peace and quiet situation and expects their victims to just shut up and go away. Well, they're not going to, because they're human beings. Mm. So if you grant them their humanity, then you understand that without justice, there will be no peace. It's the most basic thing in the world. The only situation in which you can do to them what Israel has done and is doing and expect peace is if those people that you're bombing and killing and maiming, those people you expelled in 1948, those people you occupied since 1967, are not actual human beings. And you can take that position if you want, but I wouldn't recommend you expect them to accept your dim assessment of their humanity. And if they don't, well, you're going to have a problem. So if you genuinely want peace, you might want to get interested in what does justice look like, which is to say, what does peace actually require of us, which is to give something up, which human beings hate doing, but we're going to have to do it.
Daniel Mate. Oh, I want to sneak in another question, but I don't have time. They're already giving me evil looks. That's my problem with them on this station. 5 minutes of my time is taken by the news, and then I'm told that, Anyway, look, Daniel, you're tired, but thank you so much for that generosity. Like you said, jet lag with everything going on. You know, your personal trauma as a Jewish person, your personal trauma as a lover of humanity, your personal trauma as somebody who cares about humanity, who cares about your neighbor, the Palestinians, all of the above and so much more. And for sharing your knowledge, your education, your emotion, everything with us. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Will you come back? I'm getting messages saying you have to tell him to come back. That's my Nigerian accent. You have to tell him to come back, they're saying. Will you come back?
If you tell me to come back, I'll come back. I'll jump to it.
Thank you, Daniel. Thank you so much. Sleep well. Please try and get some sleep and have a wonderful New York weekend.
All right. Thank you so much.
Take care. All the best.
Bye-bye.
Bye.